Welcome to the Breakout Growth Podcast, where Sean Ellis and Ethan Garr interview leaders from the world's fastest growing companies to get to the heart of what's really driving their growth. And now, here are your hosts, Sean Ellis and Ethan Garr.
In this week's episode of the Breakout Growth Podcast, Ethan Garr and I chat with Ron Schneiderman, the CEO of AllTrails. So if you're at all outdoorsy, then you've probably already used the AllTrails website or mobile app. Its hand-curated trail maps and treasure trove of crowdsourced photos and reviews are a great resource for navigating outdoor adventures. What I think you're going to find super interesting about this conversation is the surprising and maybe even counterintuitive story behind AllTrails growth, where product channel fit actually preceded product market fit. So Ethan, did that jump out at you as well?
Yeah, for sure. We love to dig into the stories of how fast-growing companies overcame their challenges and found product market fit. There's always great learnings there, and we always view that as the foundation of growth. But when Ron joined AllTrails, he actually found a company where organic channels were delivering an audience, but the product wasn't even close to delivering on the experiences that that audience was expecting. And now, and I think this is in part a lot to Ron's great leadership, the company was able to leverage that product channel fit into their breakout growth success.
Yeah, you know, it really bucks conventional wisdom. And while I don't think that means that product market fit is any less important, it does suggest that you can start with product channel fit and then work your way toward product market fit and still be successful.
But, right.
You know, I think this conversation is going to probably change the way that I look at companies and new opportunities. And I believe it will for our audience as well.
Yeah, I agree. And I think for startup growth teams and leaders, this is just one of those discussions where Ron's insights will really help get you thinking differently about a lot of things. I mean, you and I have both heard horror stories about private equity. Well, AllTrails just raised $150 million in private equity, and Ron may convince you to think otherwise. And you and I have probably thought about how a big fundraise can power growth, how you use it for paid channels. Ron's take on that is probably going to change your thinking on that too.
Yeah, I agree. You know, he's really smart and he comes across as super approachable.
Yeah.
You know, the more we talked, the more AllTrails sounded like an incredible place to work. So before we jump in with Ron, we invite our listeners to check out the sponsor for this week's episode, Rise with SAP S/4HANA Cloud. Hypergrowth companies get up and running quickly with this low-cost, easy-to-implement cloud ERP solution. If you're working to power breakout growth success in your business, please check out sap.com/highgrowth.
All right, well, let's get to it. And if you're listening, we'd like to ask you just one quick favor. If you can, this week, tell one friend one thing you've learned from the Breakout Growth Podcast that you found valuable.
Yeah, that would be awesome. And I also want to give a heads up to our listeners that they can now sign up for our next cohort of Go Practice, which starts on February 9th. So you can learn more about that at gopractice.io. Okay, let's go.
Yeah, it's a great course. Let's do it.
Hey, Ron, welcome to the Breakout Growth Podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, we are super excited to have you on, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ethan Garr. Hey, Ethan.
Hey, Sean. Hey, Ron. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Yeah, so We're excited to dig into AllTrails, and I'm sure anyone who's an enthusiastic hiker, biker probably knows about it. But for the lazy people of the world, like myself, who may be a little less familiar with it, can you give us an introduction to what AllTrails is and maybe the problem that it initially set out to solve?
Yeah, sure. So AllTrails is a free app and website that helps you find really great trails so you can spend more time outside enjoying the outdoors. And I guess in terms of the problem we're trying to solve, AllTrails is built on this underlying principle that people and by extension communities are happier and healthier when they spend time outside. So that's what we do. You know, we use technology to create content and products that helps people explore with confidence. I mean, it's really as simple as just trying to get people out in nature more. That's really it.
Awesome. Just a quick follow-up on that. I know you're CEO now, but you weren't actually a founder of the business. So what attracted you to the business in the first place?
Yeah. So AllTrails has been around since 2010, and it was almost like a side project for a while. It was really small. I had been doing a startup in the ski space for about 9 years called Liftopia, and outdoor tech is pretty small. Like we all kind of know each other. So the original founder of AllTrails got an opportunity to go be SVP of operations at one of the big food delivery companies. So he wanted to hand it over. And so he reached out, and there's a couple things. One, I love startups, but I don't actually like going 0 to 1. That was kind of a realization after my first, that's not my happy place. I like hyper growth.
My realization as well.
Right? Hyper growth is fun. 0 to 1 is a grind.
I don't even mind early trajectory, but just trying to figure out something that people actually want and like, that's hard. That's a lot of hit or miss.
Feels good when it works, but man, it can be a grind when it's not going well.
Right. After that first startup, it's like, all right, I never need to do that again. But the opportunity to come back and do a startup, you know, like the essence of a startup, something small and something in a space that I love, which is just spending time outside. But what sold me, it was funny, like during the interview / like sales pitch, was he opened up Google Analytics and he just showed me all of the organic traffic that was coming to AllTrails every day. And, you know, like the product was terrible and, you know, the data wasn't very good, but it was just like, oh my goodness. Like I'd never been in a situation where I didn't have to sweat the top of the funnel like that. And to have that luxury of just like a nice steady stream of users coming in, it's like, I can figure this out. Like it buys me time, right? I'm not burning cash trying to figure it out. Like I can do something with this. So that's what sold it.
And did you have, sometimes it's hard to see in Google Analytics, but do you have an insight into or a guess if it was more kind of retained traffic or it really was top of funnel of just a lot of new people coming at that time?
It was all new because the product was so bad. People were coming.
That could
in
be another indication that that's another good sign if they're sticking around.
Right. No, people were bouncing like crazy. But again, like it was, he had built to their credit, you know, to the team's credit, they had built this amazing SEO engine. And then I was like, all right, there's a diamond in the rough here, you know, and that seemed pretty fun.
I actually wanted to ask you about that. I mean, because it is incredible. I mean, you built profitability and scale. I mean, we're going to talk about some of your recent fundraising and stuff, but you built this business was built on these organic channels and it's done so well. Do you have obviously some of that started before you were there, but do you have some hypothesis as to why you were so successful with organic, and has that or impacted or informed the culture that you've worked to develop? I mean, how does it drive things today?
Yeah. I am a big believer in product channel fit, right? Like, I think it's like so often underlooked or not, you know, everyone talks about product market fit and people, you know, like, I don't know, there's a lot of really great startups. And even in our space, I've been here 6.5 years and I've seen so many great new platforms in our space, competitors try and launch that are beautifully designed and have no tech debt and like are ready to go, but they can't crack the code on product channel fit. Like that's really where I think that's what makes or breaks companies, especially in the earlier days, right? Like it's where you're gonna get your breakout velocity or not. And so seeing like such clear product channel fit with SEO at the time, and granted this was 2015, so, you know, 70% of traffic was coming on desktop and, you know, 30% was mobile web. They had just launched their mobile apps. And obviously the complexion of the business is so different today. But when I came in, we had this conversation. It's like, we're at this inflection point, you know, do we go out and just raise around or do we try and grind it out? And we made the very conscious decision to like, let's grind it. Let's see if we can get to profitability. And there was a bunch of whys behind that, but it was, I say this because it's like a core part of our like culture and our DNA today, right? And you guys have been around the block. I'm sure your listeners have been around the block. You know, I've been in this game for 20 years. I've seen so many startups like come up, get a big round of funding. And I feel like it's like taking a seed and dumping a ton of water on it too fast. It rots, right? Like it rots. You can't
I'm
do it.
I'm guilty of that.
It's a great analogy.
Yeah. And like when you're, you know, we're coming in, like it wasn't from nothing. You know, there was something here and something that was clearly working. And you come in and you do a big round and suddenly like you're getting all the pressures that come with a VC round of like spend fast, spend hard. And it's always in two different places, right? Like either on headcount. And so you lose sight of culture. Like we didn't even have like a developed culture yet, let alone like, how am I supposed to, you know, get to 50, 100, 200 people when I don't even know who we are, what we're about, what our values are, like what is our DNA? Like we needed time. And then on the channel side, right? Like again, like this is where I see this so often. I love startups. I like being involved in them. I, you know, mentor a bunch and advise. And I just see this all the time because everyone thinks that the success metric is going and getting the round, right? And what happens is you then get stuck, like, do you know, the grow at all costs. And then you're like, you're growing through unsustainable channels that like, as soon as the money dries up, you're going to wither on the vine. Right. And like, I didn't want to, you know, even though this was early days, but it's like, I want to build a multi-decade company here. I love this space. Like let's build something. And I there's nothing else I want to do. So like, let's build something long-term and sustainable. So it was really important to build that foundation, you know, and like really like, let's get like the fundamentals in place and let's get that like fiscal discipline and that scrappiness and that like, you know, like test and iterate, like mentality, like, let's just go, like, let's go, let's grind, let's build. And not just like, oh, I'm now fat and lazy because I have so much money. I don't know what to do with it. So, you know what I mean? So that was a big part of it.
Wow. You know, one of the things that really jumps out at me is this idea that you, not only are you emphasizing product channel fit, it sounds like you actually spotted product channel fit before product market fit. As you said, retention cohorts really weren't there when you came in. And, you know, conventional wisdom is always get to product market fit, then focus on scale. So it's interesting if you kind of think like, especially when that product channel fit is all organic, the demand is there. You were seeing the demand is there and just no one is really effectively fulfilling that demand. And so it's from an execution perspective, I think it's pretty interesting because it's, that you're essentially saying, gosh, if we can just get this product right, there's a huge opportunity here, but it goes against a lot of the conventional startup wisdom out there.
There's a lot of bad conventional startup wisdom out there.
Yeah. And then which, you know, one other thing that's kind of interesting, and maybe it's a little too personal on my side, but, you know, I had a conversation with my daughter the other day, and I had kind of high blood pressure on a recent doctor visit, and to the point where the doctor's like, you know, we may need to put you on medication for it, and I told my daughter I don't want to get on medication for it because then it's like I have a dependency to the medication, and I want to be able to be healthy enough that I don't need that and fix it on lifestyle. And she's like, why not just go for the medication? And so it just kind of reminded me of, it's kind of talking about weird analogies with flooding water on seeds and this, like to me, it's kind of like that dependency on medication is not that different than the dependency on venture capital, where if you can build that kind of healthy business, then venture capital flocks to you because they know you can put that money to work well. Where otherwise, yeah, you're totally beholden to the venture capital. And that's why almost every business that I spent a long time in after the first kind of dot-com one, where we actually had a lot more discipline than most people. But you know, from LogMeIn to Dropbox to a lot of these other businesses, they got to cash flow positive pretty quickly, and the amount of flexibility that gives you, and obviously a lot more upside for early shareholders and founders as well when you're not raising these massive rounds to keep you in business. So I think that dependency is a really important factor that you talked about.
The single biggest point of leverage you can get as a founder or as an executive when you're going to fundraise is to not need it, right? Like the irony of it, but it's the truth. Like if you have the power to straight up walk away and not need it, they know that. They can smell when you're desperate and you need the capital. And that's where they get to dictate the terms. And as soon as you don't need it and you can come out from that position of strength, it's a game changer.
I'll avoid going down the dating analogy there. I mean, I'm coming up on my 25th wedding anniversary, so it's all theory in my mind there. But yeah,
it's funny.
Go ahead, Ethan.
It's funny because we just recently did an interview for the podcast, and we were talking about just sort of the the importance and value of having startup experience. And in that conversation, it kind of became clear too that, like, you know, startups are very different and you have the different experiences. And I think a lot of that experience is around the funding. Like, you know, Sean was mentioning how, you know, if you're joining an organization and they have a very short runway, it's very different than a startup that's, you know, got money already and you've got some opportunity. I know I was part of Teltech and we were bootstrapped and, you know, we launched RoboKiller and we just, you know, we kept just, you know, accelerating growth and accelerating growth. And you're right. When you control your own destiny like that, it makes your conversation so much easier. You know, someone wants to partner with you, you're always in the high leverage position. You want to sell the company, you want to raise money. You're just in this high leverage position where you really get to call the shots. So it is interesting. And you know, listening to your the conversation you had a few months ago on the Sub Club podcast, it was really clear that you've gone through a couple of funding rounds, but it seems like each time you were in control of your own destiny. And I imagine that's made it really interesting for you.
And it all comes back to that initial like inflection point in 2015. Like, do we raise the round or do we try and like do this ourselves and get that foundation and that strength of being like, you know, self-piloting, self-fulfilling, whatever. You're spot on. And this is the stuff, like this is, I don't know, like the difference between a second or a third startup versus your first startup, it's just night and day, right? Like, I don't know, like the amount, like my first startup, I just look back and I made a lot of mistakes and I'm proud of the mistakes. I've learned from them and I've grown from them. But like, I look back and like the shit that I was focusing on and caring about, and then you flush that out. Like, all right, I don't, there's no ego anymore. I don't care about ego. Like the ego stuff is bullshit. And so you kind of, you know, you move on and you start thinking about stuff like funding and board dynamics and executive dynamics and product channel fit and just all of these things that, like, I don't know, at least for me, my first time around, like I had no idea about. And so I think that experience, that cumulative experience, even though everyone has been different, it becomes an asset, you know. It's like that, I don't know. You're just like the old man racquetball or old man basketball, where like they're not as fast, but like they just beat you every time because they've like mastered the fundamentals and stuff like that. I feel like that's startups. Like you're a young kid, you're just grinding, you're putting 20-hour days in, like you're hustling, you're, you know, road showing, all of it. I can't do that anymore. I'm in my 40s, you know, I'm slowing down a little bit, but I feel smarter. You know what I mean? Like I know how to deploy my energy, I guess, a little bit more wisely than before.
Yeah. I get this old man racquetball vision of, you know, the sweatband and the arms. And I'm imagining some other guy. And then, unfortunately it's me if I really look closely. You know, one of the things I think is kind of interesting as well, or something to dig into a bit is, you know, you talked about if you raise a lot of money and then you need to spend that money on growth and you can spend it kind of unsustainably, a lot of times people kind of look at it as a trade-off. Either I'm focused on growth or profitability, and it's like two different worlds. But what I found, and a kind of mental exercise I give to a lot of people when they're presenting that to me, is, you know, they say, okay, I think we can model out a lifetime value of this, so we can pay this to acquire our customers, and we'll worry about the monetization a little bit later, and we just want to do land grab right now. And then I say, okay, so you find something that you can spend $10,000 a month on that hits your allowable CPA. Now, what if you find a channel that you can spend $5 million a month on that hits that CPA? Do you have that same confidence? And usually the answer is no, where if you're investing for return on investment and you know that you're driving that return on investment, or you can model based on real numbers of how you're monetizing, you can just so much more aggressively execute and do it in a sustainable way that I think you can grow faster a lot of times when you have the discipline to make sure that you're not growing in a stupid way.
Totally agree.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, and is that something that do you think if you had raised a lot of money early on that you would actually have gotten as big as fast as you did? Or, you know, looking at it specifically, not just in the theory that I said, but actually looking at it on your company.
I, I feel like the shape of the curve would be different. You know, I feel like the high amplitude point would be like front loaded more because we'd have spent stupidly and seen a big spike and land grab kind of thing. And then it would have shrunk dramatically. And instead it's just been like this nice slow, you know, this, that we've been actively trying to like augment the slope of the curve, especially over the last couple of years.
Internal team equity probably looks a lot better the way that you've grown.
Yeah. But I think that, you know, every channel also sort of has like its plateau, you know, like you can't crank SEO indefinitely. You can't crank Apple search ads indefinitely. You can't crank PR, right? You know? So, I think that's the other thing. Like if we would have taken a lot of money up front, I'm sure we would have diffused ourselves over a lot of channels more quickly also. Whereas instead, because we were broke, we went all in on SEO. And then, you know, as we started becoming more mobile first, like taking that discipline and framework to ASO, same two sides of the same coin, right? And then really thinking through like, how do we build up in the backdrop of all this, right? Like that's fine for top of funnel, but at the same time, like how do we then build up brand equity? How do we then build up like this emotional connection? How do we like activate? We are a community driven business, right? And so like we're only still like in the earliest innings of like unlocking like the true, like, you know, like network effects and viral loops and stuff. Like I feel like we're first inning of baseball there. But they were still happening, you know, as we were like leaning on these organic growth channels. And it's all, you know, all of it was through this lens of like, can we keep growing through that? Like, how is this enough? Is this like healthy? Is this enough? And it was enough, you know, because we had that fiscal discipline. And so, you know, whatever, like, so maybe we're still like an 8-person company and maybe I'm still personally doing all the Costco orders and our ASO keywords and pretty, you know, lifecycle marketing and hiring and firing and like whatever. It's like, you know, that's part of it. I think that's what we sign up for oftentimes, you know, especially in the early
days. And when did you raise the $150 million?
That was a couple months ago.
Oh, so pretty recently. And and does that change the dynamics now? I mean, is it something that now you, or was that more take money off the table, or is that money to accelerate the business further?
So before this round, let's do a little history of all trails.
Sure, that'd be good.
So I joined in 2015, kind of took over the handoff from the original founder. That was like September of 2015. By end of 2017, we'd hit profitability. It was great. 2018 was kind of like our first like foray into hypergrowth. That's really where the business started taking off. And we got, we started getting inbound offers to buy it. And that was actually part of the original agreement with the founder, was like to grow it and sell it, right? And so, you know, it was one of the big tech companies, they wanted to buy us. And so I was like, all right, you know, like let's start this process. We spun up a bank, started, you know, matrix of 100 different potential acquirers, all the different verticals. And it was fun, it was cool. I'd never done that before. And honestly, like at Liftopia, we had done like 4 or 5 rounds and we never had leverage, ever, 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 never had leverage. And here, like we had all the leverage in the world. Cause again, like we had the agreement to sell it, but we didn't have to. Like if we didn't, we're profitable, we're good, we're growing and having fun. So it really like changed the tone and tenor and all of it, of the entire process. And so we're going through it and it was definitely this realization, like I don't want to be absorbed. And none of us wanted to be absorbed into another company and just go be middle management or whatever.
Yeah.
Like if I wanted to do that in my career, I would have done that in my career.
That's a different path.
It's a different path and it's a great path, but it's not the path for me. And like, I wanted to keep growing this, you know? And so we kind of changed who we were starting to talk to. And we started talking, you know, we started talking to the VC. It's funny how like the world of VCs and private equity started like overlapping, right? Where like VCs were going and buying majority stakes and private equity was talking to us about like growth rounds or whatever.
Yeah.
Getting a piece. it's funny. But we ended up finding, thankfully, we got lucky, but finding the right partner, which was a growth equity fund. I'd never heard of a growth equity fund, but a growth equity fund called Spectrum Equity, based in San Francisco. We're based in San Francisco. And they saw it. They got it. They're like, one of the first companies, like, Ron, you got to think bigger. Like, we let's take this global, right? Like, let's do, you know, let's like really see where we can take this. And it really opened my eyes because I think like a lot of, I don't know, maybe you guys, a lot of your listeners, a lot of PE shops get a bad reputation, and probably for a good reason, right? Like a lot of the PE shops we were talking to, like it was all bottom line stuff. It was all just like expenses and the cost management, whatever. EBITDA. I don't want to talk about EBITDA. Like we're growing. Like let's just talk about growth, right? So they got it. And it was such a good partnership. And again, I feel fortunate. I feel like I'm one of the lucky ones. Like we're All Trails is one of the lucky ones that we're able to get a good partner, and it was clean. Like at my last startup, we had done VC rounds, and every round, you know, a different VC led the round. So we had like a different VC at the board table from every round. And you get sharp elbows and you get like misaligned incentive. It was messy. You kind of had to watch your back a little bit. Here it was clean. It was like, you know, they're going to buy a controlling stake and we're going to grow it. And that's like, let's see if we can do something really great together. And to their credit.
It seems like one of the things that I mean, I don't know enough about Spectrum to make a blanket statement about them, but I know they're SurveyMonkey, right? They were.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so if you take SurveyMonkey is kind of a famous story of a bootstrap business that kind of like, wow, that's worth how much? And it was just this didn't seem like that great of a business. And and obviously then Spectrum came in and so I'm just wondering if they focus on organically like well-disciplined businesses, and if they do, then you know, I think a lot of times the private equity, it's kind of like, you know, let's bring in the professional managers now who take it to the next level. But if that's what they're valuing, they're probably less likely to buy to make major changes.
Yeah. They bought SurveyMonkey, and it was like a 12-person company or something like that. And they held it for over 10 years. Like that was actually their sales pitch. They're like, don't hear from us how we manage. Like talk to Xander Lurie, the CEO of SurveyMonkey. And to Xander's credit, like I called him, he's like, oh, hey, Ron, I was waiting for your call. You know, we chatted for like an hour about what it's like to work with Spectrum. And, you know, like that's how you really can tell. Like you talk to the folks in the portfolio, and to a T, they were all saying the same thing. And so that was 2018, right? And that was like, they bought us, we were a 12-person company too. They bought us for $80 million in like September, October of 2018. And, I feel very grateful. Like we transitioned the old CEO out, and they gave me the opportunity. I'd never been a CEO before. And they gave me the opportunity and kind of the space to figure it out as I go along and make mistakes and stuff.
Were you nervous about taking on that CEO role?
Oh, dude, I had so much imposter syndrome. Like the gremlins in my own head, like would never, oh my God. It was like 4 months of tearing myself apart on the inside. And then suddenly like it hit me. Like I just had this epiphany where it's like, cause I'm not a finance guy. Like I've never been a finance guy. I got like a C+ in econ in college. Like I'm not, my wife works at Morgan Stanley. Like she does private wealth management. Like I just glaze over when she starts talking about finance. And I always thought that like would preclude me from being a CEO. Right. But then it was like, I don't know how to code. But like, I have no problem like hiring like a CTO and engineering leads and like helping to manage like an engineering department. Like, what's the difference with finance or that? Like, the key thing is like, hire people smarter than you, give them like really clear goals and like make sure everyone's aligned, and then get the fuck out of the way. Like, it's not that actually hard. And once I like realized like my job is to get out of the way and not like hold on to everything and control and have mastery over everything. But in fact, it's the opposite. It's like, I love this job.
Was that the hardest part, do you think? Or what did you find the hardest part of taking on the CEO role?
The hardest part was just the self-flagellation I was putting myself through to like get myself comfortable with I can do this, you know? If you can't, like, I have zero ego. Like, I just don't care about ego stuff. It's bullshit. So the letting go of stuff is actually like very easy for me, and hiring people much smarter than me is very easy as well. So like that part was easy. I talk about it with folks. Like I view myself as like a music conductor, you know, like I'm just there. Like I'm there to make sure everyone's like playing the same sheet music. Like we're all playing the same song, right? We're all playing at the same tempo, same volume, the right instruments are in the right seats, the right first chair versus like all the other folks are in the right seat. And then I get out of the way and let them make their music. Right.
You're not like tempted to jump in there and grab that clarinet and go to
right. Town. I can't play the clarinet. I'm not going to do that. So no, once it took a little bit, like it really did take a little, like quite a few cycles of just like beating myself up and then finally like letting go of these gremlins and just like, okay, I got this.
This week's Breakout Growth Podcast episode is sponsored by SAP. SAP helps businesses increase productivity and achieve real-time transparency with the power and flexibility of RISE with SAP S/4HANA Cloud. If you have ambitious goals and are working to lead markets and industries, then you probably already know how important it is to align with a technology partner who will scale and drive innovation with your business. With Grow by SAP, future industry leaders like yourself don't have to rely on stitched-together solutions that don't talk to each other to manage business finances, operations, and customer relations. Instead, leveraging the flexibility of SAP's cloud-based solution, you can power all these in one place and gain unprecedented insights into the performance of your business from end to end. Whether you're on the brink of or have already achieved breakout growth success, learn more by visiting sap.com/high growth.
Do you think it was a bit of a blessing that you, as Sean was saying, that you kind of found product channel fit before product market fit? I mean, I've heard you describe that the product was kind of like not in a great place when you got there. Do you think just in terms of because of that, it's helped you kind of keep this discipline throughout it? In other words, getting the money, it sounds like you already knew as you raise money, like, hey, we can't just pour money on this to make it better. We've got to focus on the product. It's not just about more dollars spent on ads. It's not just more people. We've got to focus on getting the product right. Seems like if you have that in your, it might help in keeping disciplined and driving a culture around it.
Definitely. And you know, a lot of it's obviously shifted today, right? Then you started getting into scaling issues with product channel fit and all that. But like in the first cycle, the first couple chapters, whatever we want to call it, like pre-spectrum equity, it was really about time, right? And I felt like because we had this like free flow of users coming in every single day, and even if they were bouncing, like that's okay, like but they're finding us, or we can get them. We have a magnetism. That gave us time to figure out how to unlock. It was really just, you know, it's mid-funnel optimization, right? Like that's a lot of what we were doing. Like before I got there, my predecessor had launched the apps and the subscription business. So this was actually my first foray into a subscription business. I'd never seen one before. I didn't really understand how they worked. And, now I feel like I will never not do a subscription because they're magical. It is just an amazing business.
I always describe it as the gift that keeps on giving.
It's like the tide just keeps rising every year. It's fantastic. And it's like time, momentum, velocity, like all of these things are
just, this is the predictability of it. I remember in the, like basically within the first week of each quarter at LogMeIn, we would know really close what that quarter was going to be just based on like, what does the pipeline look like? What are the renewal? It becomes very formulaic and can be hard to accelerate, but you know, if you're not on a good trajectory, but there's just a lot of visibility in what's happening.
Totally. And so kind of to your question, sort of question, like 10 minutes ago about the funding and the $150 million round, you know, we obviously saw like tremendous growth through COVID, right? Like it was an accelerant for what we've been seeing, but it was crazy. This the slope of the curve changed so fast, so quickly. And we did a lot to capitalize on that, to be clear. Like we placed some bets and we were lucky. And that's the thing, like it's weird talking about success in COVID. There are a lot of great companies that like, you know, got really beat up or didn't make it because they had supply chain issues or, you know, field reps.
Or like Eventbrite where I was for a period of time. Dude, like, there are no events happening.
Company, right? It's an amazing company, like smart top to bottom. And they got crushed, right? Like we were lucky. We were definitely, there's luck involved. But it was funny, like we were at this, in mid-March when everything shut down, mid-March 2020, like our business ground to a halt, right? We have this like flywheel driven business and mm-hmm. everything else, right? And like no one was out hiking or biking because everyone's hoarding toilet paper and everyone's scared that dogs are going to give them COVID and the air is going to, you know, toxic.
They're not within 100 miles of someone. They're still wearing a mask.
Right. I mean, it was like we looked around. We're like, oh my God, like this is actually like the machine has halted. Like for the first time, the machine has halted and this is terrifying. But this is where one of the like patterns from just being old, I guess, and around the block for long enough kind of comes into play. Like in 2008, 2009, when I was at the ski startup, it was the same thing, right? Like the economy ground to a halt. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, wait, we're in like this
good times,
right? And we're in this like luxury, you know, like skiing. But what we found was like people actually started skiing way more because it gave people like a modicum of control. Like you lean on your habits, you lean on the things that give you joy or pleasure or happiness, right? And so it was like, oh, this is really interesting. Like, you know, even though times are tough, like people are prioritizing the things that give them some semblance of normalcy. And it was like, we have three kids, you know, we were like canceling our Disney World trip, summer camp got canceled. We're like, what the hell are we gonna do this summer with these kids? They're gonna drive us crazy. It was like, we're just gonna run them ragged on the trail. And this conversation is happening all over us, you know, and it's happening via text, it's happening in the press. And it's just like, this is our moment. Like this is what we were built for. And so while, you know, it was again, like to Spectrum's credit, right? Like the machine had stopped, it was grim. And we're like, we're going to invest. Like we're going to start hiring like crazy. We're going to start spending way more on paid ads because there's going to be an arbitrage play here. Like, we're going to increase the rate of communication. This is going to be our moment. Like, let's do this. You got, you know, and they're like, let's go, let's do this. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, like I still have a job. So it worked. So we were able to, you know, generate all this momentum and then carry it into 2021. I promise I'll get to the 150 mil raise. This is all building up to. Yeah, yeah. The two big questions as we headed into 2021 were, are the folks who signed up, we have a freemium business, All Trails Pro is our annual subscription offering. Are the people who sign up for All Trails Pro, are they going to retain, right? Like, was this just a COVID bump in subscriptions or are they actually going to like retain or, you know, not churn out? And then we look at everything through a cohort basis. And that's what's also really cool about the business. People who sign up, you know, 7 years ago will just convert to pro. All of a sudden, like they just keep kind of growing these older cohorts. Are the cohorts the users who signed up for free accounts in 2020, are they going to convert to pro? And we had to wait, you know, we had to wait till we're a seasonal business. We follow the sun. So like May, June, July was finally like, yes to both. Like, okay, the fundamentals of this business are strong. Like this is not just like the retention rates were actually higher. Pro conversion rates were higher. UGC contributions were higher. It was just like, this is not just it was an accelerant, but like, that's the beauty I think of our space is like, once you connect to the outdoors, like you're connected, it's part of you. It doesn't matter like as the world opens up or doesn't open up. Like it's sustainable. So that's what led to this, like, okay, like what are we going to do about this? What do we want to do? Right. And, we were getting a ton of like acquisition offers. I mean, same thing. Like, I like what I'm doing. I don't want to sell. we got all these SPAC offers and it's just like, all right, you know, when we go public, like we're not going to do it via SPAC. Like we're going to do it right. And we're not ready to go public. That's the other thing. I'm sure you guys have seen this a ton too, right? Like companies that went public via SPAC, they're just like, they're not ready. Like you don't have the infrastructure. You don't have the discipline. Like you're back to short-term quarterly thinking with the street, whatever.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That was a lesson from Yelp.
It's a different operating model at that point.
Totally, totally. That was like, at Yelp, that was like, don't go public. Like, and so, you know, then I was like, all right, well, like what can we do? And, or what should we do? And it was like, you know what? Like, let's see if we can bend the slope of the curve even more. Like, how do we do more faster? And it's like, well, like, can we find a new partner? Like, let's not do a change of control. Don't want to do that. I love the status quo. But can we, you know, bring on someone who brings something new to the table and adheres to, like, understands our values, right? Like, we're not going to compromise our values. We're not going to, like, I love Spectrum. I love the coverage I get. Like, we can build, we can grow, we can do like crazy things. We can give back. The bigger we get, the more we get to give back. Like, I don't take that for granted from a private equity firm. So we ran this tight process. We found six firms that we're kind of interested in that they had done, you know, partnerships with. We ran like a super tight process, basically like first conversation, like we don't want to be here. I want to be back operating my company. Like, this is the last thing I want to be doing right now, but like, let's be opportunistic and see if there's a fit here. And like, first conversation with Premiera is like, done. Like, these are the guys. And within two months, like, we were able to get a term sheet and get this thing done. And I think it's because, again, like, we had leverage, like, we could walk, we didn't need it, but it was really this opportunity to do more faster. And it's funny, like, we have a really great board, but they're always yelling at me, like, do more faster. And so this was a way to do more faster. We could suddenly like get this cushion, intentionally get a little bit less fiscally sound and like invest in like product driven growth and like the kind of team that like 2023 or 2024 will support, but do it today, do it now so we can build more faster, start placing big bets, do it at a global scale, bring on board some new DNA with this global expansion expertise. And that was the genesis of that.
And do you feel like becoming less fiscally sound is maybe okay when you have a foundation of an engine that's proven and works, and you know you can roll back to that if you take an analogy from your old business, get too far ahead of your skis? Yeah. Can you kind of regain control of things if you need to? And that's a different kind of like overspending versus kind of in the early days of a business when you're still got a lot to figure out.
It was very intentional, right? And so like, we're not altering our DNA, we're not altering our worldview, but it's like, you know what, we're good, we're in a good spot, so let's do this and let's play some bets. And so there's kind of two big manifestations of like where the funding goes. You know, one is on the headcount side. And so much of that, like we're saying, like, it's product driven growth. It's like, really, it's do more faster. It's like, place more bets, not have things be an and, not an or. Like, let's like blow out this growth team. Let's blow out, you know, like, let's build more faster. And so that, like, if our company is going to grow and become what we're going to become anyways, like, we have to do it via product driven growth. We're doing a little bit faster. If we can't grow via product driven growth, we're dead in the water. So like, either way, like, we're stress testing who we are. But I believe, you know, like, that's the bet. And then the other manifestation, or the other like, whatever, like, place to put all this money is marketing, is paid acquisition. And it's the same thing. Like, and dude, I mean, again, like, nothing you guys didn't see this last year, and I'm sure your listeners experienced the same thing. Like, paid acquisition got crazy in 2021, right? Like, CPMs and CPIs, just, they got like totally out of control. Like, stuff was tripling and quadrupling. Like, it just didn't make sense. So now it's like, all right, well, let's rethink things from first principles. And how does this change, like, on different countries and cities and continents and everything? And we can do, like, let's run a billboard test in Australia, and let's run radio ads in Berlin, and let's run podcasts and you know, whatever, right? Like, we can do more, like, at scale, at a global scale, with it being an and, not an or. So that, and if they don't work, well, cool, it's okay. Like, we can pull that back. The headcount stuff, we're locked in. We are locked in. That is a bet, right? But the marketing stuff has always been like this huge lever because of that discipline and that reliance on organic growth. Like, if we need to cut off all paid acquisition, we're good. We're still growing, right? Like, we still have so much room to grow. It's just maybe the slope is a little bit less, but it's okay.
Sure. So one last question on PE, and then we'll move away from that, I think we've established it's not kind of one size fits all on private equity. There's probably quite a difference in the types of PE firms out there. But I get this feeling that on the kind of venture capitalist side, you get VCs that are really thinking long term a lot of times. They're a lot of times kind of visionaries, or at least that's the perception I have, to where they maybe get excited about just like a business that creates a lot of impact and kind of meaning in the world. And where I get a feeling of like private equity as being more just dollars and cents, doesn't really matter what we're doing, but it's about just like, how do we keep hitting bigger and bigger numbers over time? Do you think there's any truth there? And if there is something to that, how do you keep yourself like motivated on the thing that originally attracted you, that you like the space, you like what the business is doing?
Yeah. I mean, we're getting into some like broad generalizations here, right?
Sure. And That's what I said. It's not one size fits all on all PE, and definitely not on the VC side either.
Yeah, no, I'm just giving myself coverage because I'm going to talk in some really big broad generalizations.
Okay, yeah, sure.
I don't like a lot of VCs. I really like, they're not all bad. They're not all bad, but I don't like the VC model. And I don't, some of them are visionaries, but like, I think very few of them really, really get it, get what it takes to build and operate. And I think that's why they spray and pray, right? Like, again, I'm probably gonna get a lot of bad emails from this and whatever, and that's fine. But
I think VC is going anywhere. You're not going to put them out of business.
I know, exactly, right? But I think that the value, and I think this part of the trap for a lot of startups, I think that the value that a lot of VCs bring to the table is grossly overestimated in more cases than not. The ones that I've loved the most, like First Round Capital funded Liftopia, was one of the VC rounds of Liftopia.
Yeah,
and what I loved about them,
as well.
They're great, right? Because the community, because you're plugged into this community of other founders and other companies. And like that, there was so much value that I got from that.
And Josh Koppelman is like the foundation of that group. And he's probably the most knowledgeable startup guy I've ever seen.
100%. He is a rare gem, right? Like Reid Hoffman, if you can get that guy, he's a rare gem. Like there's like the handful of guys that are like people that are like the real deal for sure. But on the whole, like I wouldn't necessarily like anoint the industry as visionaries and, you know, like are going to unlock. And on the flip side, I guess, you know, the PE guys kind of have the reputation of all being dollars and cents and it's all transactional. But I've seen this firsthand where, you know, we talked to a lot of PE. We talked to a lot, both in 2018 and over this summer. And like the Spectrum and Premier in particular, like the mission we're trying to do resonates with them. And it goes beyond the dollars and cents stuff. Like there's this like common sense of purpose and mission in here, which like gives me confidence and coverage, you know, like we can think long-term, like we can really like think about, you know, hey, what does this platform need to look like for us to get a billion people on it in the next 10 years? Like, let's talk about that. Let's plan for that. And there's beauty in that, you know, like, and that's, to me, that's unexpected, right? It goes against the grain of, I think, some of the stereotypes that, you know, one would place on most PE shops. But, you know, I think that's why, you know, like I learned this the hard way, I think, at Liftopia. And again, I'm going to get bad emails for this, but you know, every time you take on a round of funding, it's a marriage. You are intertwining with this new third-party entity. And if you really, again, when you don't have leverage, sometimes you have to compromise. But if you're able to really, really vet the values of the people that you're bringing into your company, you're in it, and the DNA like meshes and it matches, then it can be great. When there's not that alignment, it doesn't matter like what letter, you know, what VC, PE, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Like there's going to be friction. There's going to be challenges, right?
Yeah. So in all cases, it's money and it's funding. It's funding a dream or something that already exists. You're trying to take it to the next level, but it's money and it's the people behind that money that matter.
That thought of like, how do we become a billion person platform or whatever? And then kind of leads into the question I wanted to kind of close out that part of our conversation out, which is, you know, you started this company, AllTrails. I think you said it was like six people when you started, and then you reached breakout growth success. You raised raised $80 million, hit hyper growth. I mean, it just keeps rolling. Now you've got this new funding, and you know, if you can look into your crystal ball and look a year and a half, 2 years down the road, maybe, and you know, you look back at this moment and things are an absolute success and you killed it. What do you think? You know, what does that look like? What is the next chapter going to look like in your vision from here?
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel like you ask anyone at AllTrails or any of our board members or investors, and to a T, 100% of us will tell you that we're nowhere near where we can or should be, right? Like we're not there. We haven't made it. And I think it's that, like, I think that mentality, right? Like getting the round isn't the end point, it's the starting point, you know? And so what gets me really excited is product-driven growth. Like that's really like, that's what gets me, like I'm laying in bed and my wheels are spinning about product-driven growth. Like I'm taking a shower and I'm thinking about product-driven growth. Like that's where the unlock, that's where the leverage is, that's where the unlock's gonna come from, and thinking about all the different ways that we can unlock that. And as our community continues to grow, you know, we've got almost 40 million people on the platform today. Can we get to 100 million next year or the year after, right? Like it's not just having that much interactivity on the platform and what that's going to unlock, but it's also like new monetization streams and new ways of like creating products and features that like meet the needs of the folks who don't necessarily want to do an annual subscription, but are still looking for something. It's like the product market fit question again. It's like a new startup within AllTrails that we get to keep unlocking. That's fun, you know? Like, yeah, that's the stuff. I think that, I guess to answer, you know, 2 years from now, like what success will look like. I think it's, you know, we've built and scaled this team around us, like continue to level up, bring on like world-class, smart, hungry, humble people who are bought into our mission that are just fired up to connect people to the outdoors. And we're doing it globally. You know, we can see the trajectory to a billion. I think that's how I would define success. Like the billion, does it seem more or less realistic after the next 2 years? That'll be a good telling point.
Yeah, just one thing, you know, as we've spoken to leaders from fast growing companies across the spectrum, one of the things we've learned is, you know, when you go global, I mean, there's such opportunity in going global. But one of the things that Sean and I have heard over and over again is like the biggest mistake companies make when they start to go into other markets is they assume their product market fit in one market, it instantly translates into that other market. And I imagine that's even tighter on the channel market fit sort of spectrum. So like, I think not that you need my advice going into this, but it sounds like as you like, you guys are really well grounded in thinking like, well, we have to figure out each market individually, the needs individually, but it seems like it'd be an interesting challenge as you go forward.
I think, you know, I think this comes back to like the culture and DNA stuff we were talking about at the beginning. I think like humility is probably the single biggest virtue across all of our employees. Again, it's like a complete and devoid lack. We're not one of those like kingdom building companies, sharp elbows, nothing like that. It's like the mission that unites us all. And so long, you know, that's where everyone gets their, like their ego comes from the company doing well. And I think like you have to have that humility when you go into these new markets. If you just assume that what you brought you great success in the United States or whatever is just going to translate, like you're setting yourself up to fail.
I think it's particularly dangerous in the mobile app world, right? Because with mobile apps, you want to go into another market. You literally go into your app store developer account and you say, Sweden, right? But, and you just assume like, okay, well now we're in Sweden, but it's so much more than that. It's localization. It's putting boots on the ground to understand the markets. I think mobile just, you know, it entices you to make that mistake, you know, and maybe the worst part is like, you can have some success and think that you're winning just because you're in the market.
I hope you're not saying that's a cautionary tale, but it's true. You're spot on. You're spot on. It's the truth. It's so easy to check those boxes and like, yeah, no, we're global now. But to really pull it off, like, yeah, you got to rethink everything from first principles.
Yeah, when you talk about product-driven growth being kind of the engine that you think will get you to that billion people, do you think of product market fit in each of these markets as a big factor in that product-driven growth, or are you kind of thinking about product-driven growth as being something else, and why is that important? Is that somewhat of a reaction to the channels being saturated, or just you give us a little more context in the role of product-driven growth in getting you to that billion?
So what's really, I think what's fun about AllTrails is, I, again, this is my first freemium platform also, right? And so like all of our trail content is free. It's free for everybody. And we spend a lot of money producing it. We spend a lot of money translating it, you know? But again, it's because this is our mission, is to connect people to the outdoors. We can't put content behind the paywall. Like we got to get you out in nature. And so what I'm proud of about what we're doing here is the leverage that we've been able to build in the model. Like if we want to get a billion people on the platform, we don't need to have 10,000 employees here. We're not spinning up like any kind of sales teams. Like there's just a lot of scale and leverage in the foundational work that we've been investing in, right? Like I think at maturity, I don't know, maybe we have 250 people, 300 people, 400 people. I don't know. We'll see how like field marketing and stuff plays out. You know what I mean? But like, it's not the like linear rate of growth of like headcount expansion does not necessarily match with like the rate of growth for like community expansion or global expansion. So there's a lot of leverage in the machine that we've built. And so like the opportunity, you know, when Spectrum bought us, we had like, you know, 40% EBITDA margins. Like we're able to spin out cash when we want to, which is cool. Like, I'm not doing that as a flex, just to be clear. But like, there's a lot of leverage in the model. And so like, that's why like product market fit, so long as, you know, the core monetization countries are monetizing the way we need, I'm okay investing in growth in Latin America or Africa or, you know, Asia, where maybe the monetization isn't there. Like, we already see it, you know, like, they're not buying an annual subscription for 30 euro or 30 pounds or 30 bucks, you know, like, so maybe we go to like smaller microtransactions or a la carte, and it doesn't need to be as big of a line item because, again, like, the fiscal health of the overall business driven by our core markets, right? So like, that's kind of the way I think about it, I guess, in terms of product market fit, like, from specifically from like a monetization perspective. Like, there's so much leverage here. We're healthy. We're good. You know, we're good. We're healthy. It's okay. Like, I don't know. Like, I'm about to get on a tangent about Facebook, I guess. I'm going to stop myself on that. But like, it doesn't need to be insane. So long as the company is healthy, we're all good. Cool. Like, let's then like do some good in the world and connect people to nature.
So it sounds like with that, you're going to invest in headcount. What are some of the key roles you're looking to fill right now? And you want, feel free to tell our audience that, you know, do a sales pitch for who you want to hire.
Oh, I love this. Okay. Well, we're actually hiring for a VP of international right now and a head of biz dev. No, I think, you know, for us, product development is the single biggest area of investment, right? So we're always hiring PMs, product designers, iOS, Android, front end, back end, tech leads, all of it. Like, we're really, it's been cool. We've been kind of like breaking up like this monolithic approach to product development and going to like fully staffed Scrum teams where each one has like a PM, a product designer, a data analyst, iOS, Android, front end, back end, QA. And it's great because each one is independent, fully staffed, has their own capacity plan, has their own roadmaps, but there's a lot of cardinality in that when you take one and then suddenly you have like 6, 8, 10 of them, right? So each time we have to get like fully staffed, but we're doing that right now. We're in the throes of it. So that's been a lot of fun. And then we finally, we just hired a CMO in November. She just started. And so marketing is probably like the single most underfunded department in the whole company. Cause again, we've had this great product channel fit, but as we grow globally, we need to rethink stuff. And so we're starting to slowly fill that one out, which is great. And I'm super excited about the leverage that's going to come from that. So yeah, we got a ton of open roles right now, if anyone's interested.
So two questions on that. One would be, how should people find, you know, should they email you, or what's the best way to find those roles and talk to you?
Yeah, don't email me directly. I'm already going to get enough.
Yeah, they're already going to be emailing you about your VC comments.
I know.
Add it to the end.
Yeah, no, just go, you know, alltrails.com, then click on careers in the footer. Check out all of those open roles or our LinkedIn page. But yeah, thanks for giving me the opportunity to shill a little bit for our open recs.
But like, I also think this has been, as we've asked about people, you know, our guests about who they're hiring, I'd like to ask too, like, what do you see if you look at someone who's going to be successful at AllTrails and that, you know, a year from now, they're killing it and, you know, they're walking the halls, and you're just like, you're the man, I'm glad we hired you, or you're the woman, I'm glad I hired you. What do they look like?
Not having too much ego.
Yeah. What's key in that for that success?
I was just talking, we're also hiring for a head of analytics role. So I was talking with a head of analytics candidate this morning about exactly this. I think there's three main characters. It's funny, like, I actually still spend a lot of time sourcing candidates myself, and reaching out and just like, I want the best. I want to surround myself with people. Like a conductor. I want to surround myself with musicians way better than I ever will be. And so I think that there's three main characteristics that's like fed into our culture. One is like getting the smartest people we can find, right? Just like super smart people, because I still consider us small, who can hit the ground running on day one, who bring that relevant experience, but like who still bring that like learner's mindset though, and are just like hungry to do more. Our executive team, for example, like, I was never CEO until I was CEO. Our CFO here was never CFO until he was CFO. Our CPO was never CPO. Our CTO, our CMO, like, all of these are first-time C-level hires. And we do that across the board. I love giving people that step up. I think there's so much. That's like, honestly, like, I think one of our secret weapons. And hey, listeners, take this. This is a good one. Give people that opportunity for that new role for the first time. like the hunger that they're going to bring, like that attitude that they're going to bring, that chip on their shoulder, like that prove it. And then that loyalty and gratitude too for getting that chance. It's huge from a retention perspective and also from like an output perspective. So I love doing that, but none of it works. You're going to get sharp elbows and snakes in the grass if you don't have that layer of humility. And that's really what like makes it all work is like, and I think we're, you know, again, we're fortunate. We have a very strong mission. We're a mission-driven company, and it's all about like connection to nature and time outside. And so rallying people around that, like it's very easy to find the folks who are here. I don't like the Silicon Valley mercenaries. I won't hire them. I don't want people who are coming to Altros because they see our trajectory and think they're going to get a payday, right? Like that's not why you should come work at Altros. If you want to come like be a part of what we're building, and again, trying to get a billion people around the globe to connect to nature and all the like good downstream things that should hopefully come from that, like those are the people we want, right? So it's that like kind of humility, like, yeah. So
how do you vet for humility?
It comes out pretty quickly. I still interview almost everyone too. It comes out pretty quickly. You can tell who are me guys and people who are team guys. You know, like, do you throw your old coworkers under the bus? Are you talking shit about your old company? Like, are you just like, is it I, me all the time, you know? Or is it like, I don't know. Like, I feel like the most humble candidates, like they actually ask a lot of questions, right? Like, I think that's important. That's really telling when people just talk at you in an interview process for a job the whole time. It's like, I don't know. There's like, just pick up on it.
This is great, Sean. We've been talking to him for an hour. We've only asked questions. So I think we passed the test.
Where do we apply?
Yeah, you guys can definitely come work at
Altros. Yeah, I just to, you know, take it back to the mission that you talked about, you know, connecting people to the outdoors. I tongue in cheek said in the beginning that I'm a pretty lazy guy, so I'd never heard of it, but not that lazy. I'm a rut person. Like I do the same walk every single day. And when I downloaded the app, I saw people's rating of that walk and I started to see there's a lot of other walks near me. I'm in Laguna Beach, so it's a beautiful place for lots of walks. And so, you know, kind of from the mission perspective, you're one person closer to the billion, and that ultimately, you know, getting to that billion is one person at a time. But like, I think it will add value for me and connect me to the outdoors and help with the blood pressure and all the other health things that you know, a 50 something struggles with. And so, I appreciate that you're putting the effort into what you guys are doing there. And I have no doubt that a billion people can benefit from it and will if you guys keep doing what you're doing.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. I appreciate you guys both. And thanks for giving me the chance to come and talk on here for an hour or two. This was fun.
Absolutely. And I know the listeners are going to get a lot of value out of hearing your story and there'll be some good things they can take from it.
Yeah, I think I'm going to coin the word humility-driven growth out of this. I seriously, I love it. I think that's my favorite people to work with. Humility was a key characteristic. And I think it's, I'm not going to claim that I've always had the humbleness I should have all the time, but I do think it's such a great, if your culture is built around that, it's such a great starting point. And just seeing how you've gone through the mindset, even through raising huge amounts of capital, and kept that in focus. I'm so impressed. I was super excited when you agreed to come on the podcast, and that like I honestly could sit here and talk for another hour if you were up for it.
Yeah, we're gonna cut him off. But yeah, one other thing on the humility side is that I do think data, really having you know, persistence in and discipline in using data to have that feedback loop on the decisions you're making, brings a lot of humility, because you realize you don't have all the answers. All you have is the process to try a lot of stuff, and the data will shake out what works and what doesn't.
Well said. Yeah, no, thank you. This was fun. I could keep going too, but we'll spare your listeners here. But
we'll cut off the recording, then we'll keep going anyway. So,
perfect.
Thank you very much. And we'll look forward to continuing to watch the success as you keep cranking away with Altrails.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Breakout Growth Podcast. Please take a moment to leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. And while you're at it, subscribe so you never miss a show. Until next week.